So this week, I'm very happy to welcome Kiana Wan to give the quantum information seminar. So Kiana actually was at PI as a summer intern a couple of years back, so maybe she's a familiar face to some, and she's currently doing her PhD at Stanford. And this talk I actually saw, I think, a short version at QIP, and it was one of my favorite talks there, so I'm looking forward to this. So please take it away, Kiana.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me. Like Michael said, I spent quite a lot of time during my undergrad at PI, so it's nice to be back in some sense. So today I'll be talking about some recent work with my collaborators. So Soonwon and Isaac were postdocs in the area at the time. Now they're faculty. Noah Shetty is another PhD student of Patrick Hayden's, who's my advisor. So in our paper, we propose and analyze schemes for fault-tolerantly generating useful cluster states using a small number of experimental components in the hope that this might open up new avenues toward fault-tolerant architectures that might be more easily scalable. Okay, so our work was mainly inspired by a proposal a few years back by Soonwon and some of his collaborators for preparing two-dimensional cluster states. And this was in turn based on the earlier so-called photonic machine gun proposal of Lindner and Rudolph, which prepared one-dimensional cluster states. And both of these protocols, the idea is to sequentially generate photonic cluster states using a single photon emitter. The extension from one dimension to two dimensions was achieved by adding in routers and a delay line so that the emitted photons can come back and interact with the emitter again after being emitted. But even though two-dimensional cluster states are resources, they're universal resources for measurement-based quantum computation. They're not known to be useful resources for universal fault-tolerant computation. So what we wanted was to extend the earlier protocols to three-dimensional cluster states. And in particular, we focused on the three-dimensional lattice that was introduced by Rasingdorf, Harrington, and Stoyel, which they refer to about as the BCC lattice. And I'll talk a bit more about this in a second. So the cluster state defined by this lattice is a universal resource for fault tolerance computation. More specifically, if you're given this cluster state, you can fault tolerantly perform computation by making single qubit measurements in one of, let's say, three or four different spaces. So perhaps the more involved step is actually going to be preparing this cluster state. And what we do is we show how to do this using, first of all, an experimentally feasible setup, in particular, a setup that's compatible with existing technologies, but also implementable using a small number of components within these technologies. And two, at the same time, we need the preparation procedure to be fault tolerant so that even though the various experimental components are going to be noisy, the resulting errors on the cluster state you prepare are still going to be correctable. Sorry. So for the first point, we generalize the previous single emitter proposals, making necessary modifications so as to produce the BCC lattice. But the basic setup remains the same. You have a quantum emitter, which could be an atom, quantum dot, transmon, and it's going to sequentially emit and re-interact with photons or phonons that are stored in a delay line between these interactions. Sorry, there was supposed to be a picture that popped up, but it didn't. But anyway, but you can maybe see that this kind of single emitter setup seems to be sort of at odds with the second requirement of preserving fault tolerance. Because you'd expect that if an error occurs on the emitter at some point during the procedure, then because the emitter is interacting with every photon or phonon multiple times, then this error will spread to all of the qubits that the emitter will subsequently interact with. But we'll eventually see why this is okay. And of course, like, feel free to interrupt me with questions at any time. Okay, so before we really like dive into the technical details, I wanted to quickly review like why we care about this particular lattice at a high level, just so we're all on the same page. So in this talk, I'll be talking about this BCC lattice a lot. And you'll notice, I guess, from the picture of the elementary cell that it's not actually the body centered qubit lattice per se. Rather, it's more like you take a simple qubit lattice and you remove the sites that would correspond to a body centered qubit lattice. So it still has BCC symmetry. But in any case, a simple way, in my opinion, to understand the fault tolerance properties of this lattice is by viewing it as sort of a foliation of a surface code. And what I mean is, okay, if we just look at the first layer of this lattice, you'll see it sort of suspiciously resembles a surface code, but with a few extra qubits. And indeed, if you think about how stabilizer measurements are usually performed on the surface code, you need to introduce ancilla qubits that are entangled with, let's say, four other qubits for each stabilizer generator. And then you subsequently measure the ancilla qubit in order to measure the stabilizer. But if you imagine you entangle these ancilla qubits and haven't done the measurements yet, then that's sort of what you would get for the first layer of this cluster state. And then for the subsequent layers, we're essentially teleporting the surface code qubits into the next layer by making these entangling gates. And so instead of like in the usual 2D surface code, we're imagining doing many rounds of syndrome measurements on the same surface of qubits. Here we're sort of trading the time direction for space by just teleporting the state of the first layer onto subsequent layers. So if you imagined applying all of the gates first and doing the measurements after, then the cluster state is what you would get like right before you did the measurement. So to be a bit more technical, let's define what a cluster state is. So cluster states are naturally associated with graphs. Any graph defines a cluster state if we identify each vertex of the graph with a qubit that's going to be initialized in the plus state, the plus one eigenvalue of the x operator. And each edge of the graph will correspond to a controlled z gate applied between the two vertices of that edge. So because control z is symmetric, this naturally corresponds to an undirected graph. And you can see that this definition immediately suggests a very, at least, conceptual way for preparing arbitrary cluster states. You initialize each qubit in the plus state, and then you apply control z gates between each pair of qubits that share an edge in the graph. So here's an example of this kind of circuit for this simple triangle graph. And of course, any BCC lattice that we might want to prepare can, in theory, be generated in the same fashion. But the drawback of this approach is that it involves applying gates between all the different pairs of qubits that share an edge in the graph. And from a practical point of view, all of these gates need to be carefully calibrated and implemented. So in order to avoid the potential experimental challenges that are associated with having to calibrate and control an extensive number of these interactions, whereby extensive, I mean it sort of scales with the size of your graph. In our paper, we consider instead a setting where a single ancillary system, which I'll call Q, mediates all of the interactions between the cluster state qubits, which I'll refer to as data qubits. So physically, Q can be thought of as a single actively controlled qubit. In the experimental setups that we're going to consider, it represents the emitter, while the data qubits are going to be identical degrees of freedom, such as bosons or phonons, that passively interact with Q. And in particular, these data qubits will be sort of traveling modes, which interact with the emitter that's stationary as they pass by. So as long as there isn't significant variation in time in the experimental setup, each data qubit will interact with Q in the same way. So then it suffices to just calibrate a fixed constant number of different interactions, constant independent of the number of data qubits that you want to put in the cluster state. Also, another nice feature of using photons or phonons, photons especially, is that they don't interact with each other. So we don't have to worry about unwanted couplings between the data qubits. So under this sort of abstract constraint that we want every two-qubit gate to only be between Q and one of the data qubits, while the data qubits never interact with each other, how can we prepare cluster states? And the most straightforward thing you might try doing is using swap gates to indirectly apply all of the requisite controlled Z gates using Q as sort of like an intermediary. So as an example of this, if we go back to the triangle graph, we can apply the controlled Z between qubits 1 and 2 by first applying a controlled Z between Q and 1, indicated by this edge, and then swapping Q with 2 to sort of swap this edge onto 2. And similarly for qubit 3, which shares edges with both qubits 1 and 2, we do the CZ. We do CZ between Q and 1 and Q and 2, and then we swap these edges onto 3 by applying a swap gate between Q and 3. So notice also that here we didn't need to initialize all the qubits at the beginning. Instead, we initialized one qubit at a time and added it to the cluster state. And we can think of this as corresponding to the quantum emitter Q, generating data qubits one by one, sort of sequentially building up the cluster state. Okay, so this is all pretty simple, but we didn't end up using this approach due to experimental considerations. So for photonic and phononic platforms, we had a way of implementing the swap gate in a single rail encoding scheme of the data qubits. In a single rail scheme, what I mean is you encode the qubit degrees of freedom in the absence or presence of a photon, for instance. But obviously in such a scheme, losses aren't detectable. Since if you lose a photon and you don't see it, you might just interpret that as zero rather than knowing that it was a loss error. Whereas obviously in a more realistic practical setting, photon loss or phonon loss will almost certainly be an issue. So what we want is a dual rail scheme in which losses can be detected. But we couldn't come up with an easy method for implementing swap in a dual rail encoding scheme. So instead of using swap gates, we use the circuit identity here, which was also exploited in previous work. And this allows you to replace a swap gate followed by a controlled Z with a controlled NOT gate followed by a Hadamard on Q. And this works for any state of Q, even if it's entangled with other qubits, as long as the data qubit is initialized in the zero state rather than in the plus state. And we show how these controlled NOT and Hadamard gates can be implemented in both single and dual rail schemes. So here I'll just sort of go over how you might implement these gates in the dual rail scheme. So a data qubit degree of freedom in the dual rail scheme is going to be encoded in two distinct internal modes of a single photon or phonon, such as different polarizations or frequencies. And for the emitter Q, we consider a system with five states, three stable states that are called 0, 0 primed, and 1, and two radiative states called E and E prime. And we'll use the states 0 and 1 as the two qubit states for Q. Sorry. And we also assume that E, the state E, rapidly decays into the state 1 by emitting a photon or phonon into the waveguide. And similarly, E primed decays into 1 and the photons or phonons emitted from E and E primed are distinguishable by their internal modes. And we'll associate these two different modes with the creation operators B naught Deiter and B1 Deiter. So here's a process that has the net effect of emitting a photon or phonon labeled by I that's entangled with the emitter as if we had started in the zero state for qubit I and applied a C naught from Q to I. So first, a resonant pi pulse is applied to move zero to zero primed. So here, all we've changed is the zero to a zero primed. And then a resonant excitation pulses are applied to both the one to E and zero prime to E primed transitions, which will be followed by the emission of a photon or phonon in B1 or B0, conditioned on the state of the emitter. So this is what you see here. And finally, another resonant pi pulse is used to move the population from zero primed back to zero. So we see that if we identify the zero state of the data qubit with the internal mode B0 and the one state with B1, then the net effect of all of these processes is equivalent to having applied a C0 from Q to the data qubit, start with the data qubit starting in a zero state. Okay, so we see that C0 is implemented actively by a sequence of pulses. And on the other hand, the controlled Z gate can be implemented passively, simply by scattering a propagating photon or phonon against the emitter. So the action of CZ on the basis states is to add a minus one phase if both qubits are in the one state, and to leave the other basis states invariant. So if Q is in the state zero, the propagating mode remains unaffected due to the absence of any resonant couplings. Whereas if Q is in the state one, a data qubit that's in the one state is scattered by Q due to the resonant transition between one and the state E of the emitter. And this gives rise to a scattering phase that could be engineered to be minus one. And finally, since the B0 mode doesn't interact with the one states of the emitter, states with the data qubit in the zero state also don't require a phase. Okay, it's awfully quiet. Feel free to ask questions if I went through that a bit quickly. Okay, so we see that by using this trick, you can write down circuits for preparing arbitrary cluster states in which each of the gates are experimentally implementable. But in addition to being able to implement the individual gates, the experimental setup also has to be compatible with the order in which all of these different operations have to be applied. So even though this kind of thing works for arbitrary graphs, you can imagine that periodic structures like a lattice are going to be much easier to implement in practice. So now I'll illustrate how all of this works together in the single emitter and ley line setup for a simple example lattice. So here I'm going to simultaneously build up the circuit, grow the cluster state, and show how the photons are moving around in the setup. And we'll consider this a 3x3 square lattice with these twisted periodic boundary conditions. And in general, for an L by L lattice, the delay line will have length proportional to L. So here the delay line has length proportional to 3. As I mentioned, Q can be instantiated by an atom, artificial atom, quantum dot, etc., that emits photons, or the data qubits could be transmons, and the data qubits can be phonons, and Q could be a transmon coupled to a phononic waveguide. But to be concrete, I'm just going to say the words photon and atom for the data qubits and Q respectively. So the atom is first going to emit photon one. And just to clarify, as we saw, the physical mechanism that implements a C0 gate actually emits a photon with a C0 applied to it. So what I mean by that is that even though here the circuit says that all the data qubits are starting in the zero state, physically, it's more like restarts in the vacuum state for all the photons. And the atom emits a photon that's entangled with it, as it would be described by a xenon. Then we apply Hadamard to the atom by applying a pi over two pulse. So recall that together with the xenon, this implements swap followed by CZ between Q and 1. And then when we do xenon and Hadamard on photon 2, it has the effect of swapping Q and 2 and applies a CZ between Q and 2. And then same thing for photon 3. But then before photon 4 is emitted, the first photon, photon 1, will be guided back to the atom, and a CZ gate between Q and 1 will be passively implemented by the scattering process we saw. So then when photon 4 gets emitted, the CNOT and Hadamard will effectively swap this edge that Q had with 1 onto 4. And similar thing with photons 2 and 5, and 3 and 6, and so on until we've made the full lattice. So we see that the length of the delay line sort of ensures that the photons kind of line up in the right way so that they interact with the atom in the correct order. And now to augment this into 3 dimensions, we simply add in a second longer delay line. And with the second delay line, each photon will come back to the atom twice before being measured at the end. And this additional interaction with the atom allows us to add the cluster state edges that are going in the third, going along the third dimension. So recall that the length of the first delay line was proportional to L. The second delay line will basically have length proportional to L squared minus L. And again, this is to ensure that the qubits, the photons sort of line up in the right way so as to realize a qubit lattice. And here on the bottom, I've only shown the first part of the circuit because I couldn't fit the full circuit on the slide. And this first bit adds in the first 12 qubits. And the rest of the circuit essentially repeats as you'd expect. The interactions are all nice and periodic. Okay, and to make things even more exciting, if we color in the two delay lines, then the corresponding colors on the circuit here show you which delay line each photon is in at each point in time. Okay, so now we have an experimentally compatible scheme for generating 3D, 3-dimensional cluster states, but there's still some major issues to iron out. The first is that, okay, we didn't just want a way of preparing 3-dimensional cluster states. We wanted the procedure to be fault tolerant so that we can then use these prepared cluster states as a resource for subsequent fault tolerance computation. But in the procedure, we had this one qubit Q interacting with every other qubit like 3 or 4 times. So you might naively expect that if an error occurred on Q during this procedure, it would spread to many, many of the data qubits. And you would be right, but in a sense. So let's consider as an example this 3-dimensional qubit lattice. It's rectangular because that way I could fit the entire circuit on the slide. And suppose that a Pauli-Edz error, occurs on qubit Q at this point in the middle of the circuit. So then by using the usual conjugation rules for Clifford gates, we can propagate this single qubit error through the rest of the gates in the circuit and see that it results in this large error on half of the data qubits in the final state. And I guess there should also be a set here. Sorry. So this looks pretty bad, but it turns out that under stabilizers of the cluster state, the error is actually equivalent to a single qubit error on the data qubits. Recall for a cluster state associated with some graph G, its stabilizer generators are given by Pauli-Edz on some qubit I tensored with Z on the neighbors of I in the graph G. So for this lattice, these are the stabilizers corresponding to I equals 8 and I equals 10. And this might not be super clear from the diagram because I left out some of the edges on the boundary for clarity, but you can trust me that these are the correct stabilizers. And if we multiplied are big red error on the side by these two stabilizers. And you can see that everything cancels out except for the Z error on qubit 7. So we see that this large propagated error actually has the same effect on the prepared cluster state as a very small error. And this is true more generally. So for any single qubit error occurring at any space-time location in the circuit, including on Q, so any error occurring on any data qubit at any depth, the effect of the circuit level error on the prepared cluster state is going to be supported on some subset of the neighborhood of some data qubit. So it's not always going to be a single qubit error, like we saw in the example, but it'll always be confined to a local region of the final cluster state. And in particular, if the cluster state graph has constant degree, like this lattice does, then this means that the effective errors will all have constant weight. And I'll sketch the intuition behind why this claim is true. And let's use the same example circuit to illustrate some of the main ideas. So the first thing to notice is that if a Z error occurs on the data qubit, it either happens before or after the C naught on that qubit. Note that there's only one C naught on each data qubit. And if it occurs before the C naught, then it has no effect because each data qubit starts in the zero state, which is invariant under Pauli Z. On the other hand, if the Z error occurs after the C naught, then it commutes with all of the subsequent gates on that qubit, which are all controlled Z gates. And so the circuit level error simply ends up as a single qubit error on the final state. And the second key observation is that at every point in the circuit, the instantaneous state of the qubits is a cluster state. And these intermediate cluster states are all going to be closely related to the final target cluster state we're trying to make. So as an example, if we consider this point in the circuit, that's indicated by the dashed line, the instantaneous state looks something like this. So it's sort of like a partial cluster state or a partial version of the cluster state we want to prepare. And a few slides ago, we considered what happened if an X error occurred on Q at this precise point. So now, since qubit 7 is currently the only neighbor of Q in the graph, X on Q and Z on 7 is a stabilizer of this cluster state. So this X error on Q is equivalent to a Z error on 7. And then this Z error just commutes with all the subsequent control Z gates and ends up as a single qubit Z error on the final state, just like we saw before. So the point is, because every intermediate state is a cluster state, that's basically a subgraph of the target graph, whenever we have an X error, we can always push it via stabilizers to Z errors on the neighboring qubits, and then these Z errors will commute with the rest of the circuit. And the reason that the final errors are always confined to the neighborhood of some qubit has to do with the way that Q is used to sequentially build up the cluster state. So we saw earlier that every time we add in a new qubit, we first made edges between Q and the neighbors of that new qubit, or that the neighbors the new qubit is supposed to have. And then we swap these edges onto the new qubit. So for example, consider this later point in the circuit. We're about to add in a qubit, the 10th qubit. So we've applied control Z gates between Q and the neighbors of 10, which are 4 and 7, and we're about to swap them onto 10. So if an X error occurs on Q at this point, then it'll be equivalent to Z errors on 4 and 7. And then these Z errors commute with the rest of the circuit. So this will result in Z errors on some of the nearest neighbors of 10 in the final state. And just to go back a tiny bit, here I made a mistake. There shouldn't be a Z error here because that'll be canceled by some of the propagated errors. Okay, so this is how you'd prove that any single circuit level error leads to a geometrically local error on the prepared cluster state. And more generally, If we have m different errors in the circuit, this will result in m of these geometrically local errors on the final state. So even though I've only sort of sketched how you prove it for a single error occurring, if you have multiple errors, then the same property is true up to sign. So given these results, it's perhaps not surprising that the scheme has a finite threshold for circuit errors, despite the seemingly highly non-local propagation of errors through the circuit. But before we can really talk about error correction, we have to address sort of problem zero, which is that the experimental setup I described naturally realizes the geometry of a cubic lattice. But as we said, what we really want to prepare is the BCC lattice. but because the BCC lattice is clearly a subgraph of the cubic lattice, this can be done without changing the setup very much. One way would be to first prepare the cubic lattice and then remove the qubits that are in the cubic lattice, but not in the BCC lattice, by measuring them in the Z basis. So Z measurements remove qubits from cluster states. And another approach is to just have the emitter not emit these unwanted qubits in the first place. So what I mean is, so here you would go along adding qubits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as usual, as if you were creating a qubit lattice, except every time you come to a lattice site that's missing a qubit relative to the qubit lattice, so here lattice site 6, you skip the excitation pulse that would have emitted that photon. And because remember, we are assuming that Q can be actively controlled. And then you apply, you emit qubit 7 as usual, but when you get to qubit 8, you skip the excitation pulse and so on. So every time you come to a lattice site that's missing a qubit relative to the qubit lattice, you simply skip that excitation pulse. Okay, so now let's talk a bit about thresholds for this scheme. So for our threshold calculations, we consider the usual depolarizing noise model for what I'll be referring to as gate errors, even though these will actually include measurement errors, as well as state initialization errors. And in this model, each error is modeled by the perfect operation followed or preceded by either single or two qubit depolarizing noise, depending on the relevant qubits. And we use the very basic minimum weight perfect matching decoder. So here's a plot of the logical error rates versus the physical error rates for storing one logical qubit in an L by L by L lattice for various values of L. And this gives a threshold of approximately 0.4%, which is comparable to the threshold for the standard cluster state preparation procedure that Rausendorf and co-authors considered. And then this procedure, you just apply a control Z gate for each edge in the lattice. And under the same noise model and using the same decoder, the standard approach had a threshold of 0.58%. So intuitively, it made sense that we have a slightly lower threshold. In the standard control Z circuit, there's basically only 2 gates per qubit, whereas in our circuit, there's around 4 gates per qubit. So there's just more opportunities for error to occur under the same noise model. But it's somewhat surprising that the thresholds are close at first if you look at it and you think that the errors are propagating very non-locally. And as shown by Barrett and Stace, the BCC lattice is also quite robust against qubit losses that are detectable. So experimentally, if we were to use the dual rail scheme in which losses can be detected, we could do error correction even in the presence of loss errors. So here we consider the same noise model for the gate errors. And in addition, each qubit is lost with probability p sub loss at some point during the procedure. So here the shaded region is the correctable region of parameter space in the sense that if the gate error rate and loss probability are such that they're within this region, then the logical error probability could be made arbitrarily small by increasing the lattice size. But this whole discussion implicitly assumed that the loss probability is constant, independent of the lattice size. But remember that each qubit is stored in delay lines between its interactions with the emitter, and the length of these delay lines depends on the number of qubits. In particular, the total length is proportional to L squared, where L is the linear size of the lattice. So what this means is that if the delay line is lossy or otherwise noisy in some way, there won't be a threshold below which the logical error rate can be made arbitrarily small by increasing the system size. Making L larger makes the code better, but it also increases the total error that's going to be accumulated in these delay lines. But we'll see that for sufficiently low error rates in the delay line, the logical error probability could be made exponentially small in the delay line error rate. So more explicitly, let's let N represent a delay line error rate such that the total probability of error on a qubit due to its being stored in the delay line is eta L squared. And on the other hand, the distance of the underlying surface code is proportional to L. So for a given value of eta and a given gate error rate, P, we expect that as we increase the lattice size, L, there's going to be a trade-off between the better error suppression due to the larger code distance and the cumulative error incurred in the delay line, which scales as L squared. In other words, increasing L decreases the logical error probability, provided that P is below threshold, or the total error is below threshold, rather. But increasing L increases this total error probability until it eventually exceeds the threshold. So heuristically, we expect that there is going to be some optimal value of L that minimizes the logical error probability. And we can see, just using a simple scaling argument, that this optimal logical probability will decrease exponentially with the square root of eta. And this is roughly because you expect this the optimal L to be such that eta L squared is proportional to the gate error, to the threshold error rate, which is a constant. And our numerical results agree with this heuristic estimate. So as an example, we fixed the gate error rate to be 10 to the minus 3, which is a value below threshold. And suppose that the delay line errors are dominated by loss. Then we calculated the optimal logical error rates for various values of eta loss and found that it fits the exponential scaling with eta loss very well, with the square root of eta loss. So then a natural question to ask is, for what values of eta is it actually advantageous to use the delay line rather than not use this error correction scheme at all? And to answer the question, we calculated the break-even point beyond which the logical error rate becomes lower than the bare physical error rate of 10 to the minus 3. And from the numerical data, the break-even point for loss is around eta loss equals 7 times 10 to the minus 4. And for comparison, in the optical domain, we estimated eta loss to be around 9 times 10 to the minus 4 for an optical fiber, assuming a generic pulse-to-pulse separation. So this is close to the break-even point, but not quite there yet. And I should mention that even though I've been saying the words photon a lot, another system that's actually emerging as a very promising platform, perhaps more promising than photons and atoms for this scheme, involves a transmon qubit coupled piezoelectrically to a phononic waveguide. And for this kind of system, we saw that dephasing was likely to be a bigger problem than loss, whereas loss is actually not that big of an issue. So we did the same kind of analysis for dephasing errors in the delay line and found a similar exponential decay and also calculated the break-even point. And by our estimates, the dephasing rate for phononic waveguide is also not at the break-even point yet. But phononics, but this is for like the very first experiments in phononics, it's a rapidly developing field, and there do seem to be a lot of prospects for significant improvement. Okay, so the upshot is current experimental estimates suggest that we're not at the break-even point yet, but it's perhaps worth noting that once we do get past the break-even point, then because of this rapid exponential decay with the logical error rates with the eta, small decreases in eta could lead to very large reductions in the logical error rate. So yeah, sure, you need to get down to eta equals 10 to the minus 4 to even get back the break-even logical error rate of 10 to the minus 3. But then if you get eta down a bit further to 10 to the minus 5, then you can in principle get a logical error rate of around 10 to the minus 15. And this is without having to improve the gate fidelity at all. The gate fidelity here is fits at 0.1%. So even if the gate error rate is this like high-ish sub-threshold value, making small incremental improvements to just the quality of the delay line could give you significant gains in terms of the logical error rate. Okay, so to summarize, there's a few features of a protocol which make it interesting and perhaps promising. The first is that it shows that it's in principle possible to achieve fault tolerance with a constant number of physical components. We have one emitter, two delay lines, and a few routers and detectors. And for sufficiently low error rates, we can scale up the number of physical qubits and suppress the logical error by simply putting more photons or phonons into the same delay lines without having to add in more control qubits or other components. And this can be contrasted with platforms such as superconducting qubits, where each physical qubit often needs to be separately manufactured, calibrated, and controlled. So adding in more qubits to make your logical qubit better requires fabricating and controlling more components. And yet, despite this first point, despite this low component setup, in which every interaction is mediated by a single qubit, our protocol is nevertheless fault tolerant with similar thresholds to the standard procedure. And this is due to this error propagation property that might seem a bit surprising or counterintuitive at first. So from a more theoretical perspective, usually to mitigate the spread of errors, we often try to use transversal gates in our circuit design or make intermediate syndrome measurements and do active error correction and so on. But here we don't do any of that, even though we have a circuit that on the face of it looks very bad from a fault tolerance perspective. And yet all the circuit level errors lead ultimately to local errors. And this is actually true for using our algorithm for preparing arbitrary graphs and not just the BCC lattice that I've been focusing on. So it'd be interesting to see whether this kind of idea can be used to design other fault tolerant protocols. And also an open problem is perhaps to find necessary or sufficient conditions under which a state preparation protocol has this property. So, because this is not a generic feature of Clifford circuits or even generally true for cluster state preparation circuits. And you can see the paper for some counterexamples. And also, in contrast to a lot of fault tolerance schemes, where you assume you have just a lot of physical qubits that are fairly homogeneous and have the same noise properties, here we have a hybrid design that really exploits the different strengths of two kinds of qubits. The data qubits are these propagating modes that maybe have long coherence times and don't interact with each other in unwanted ways. But on the other hand, you don't directly apply gates to them. Whereas the emitter is something we assume you can actively control, apply gates to, and it interacts with the data qubits, but it may have much worse noise properties. So as we saw, it suffices to just get the emitter error rate below some fit threshold value, which is on the order of a fraction of a percent. In particular, we don't have to keep improving the emitter in order to get fault tolerance, in order to get this exponential suppression in error in terms of the delay line coherence time. So finally, as a result of these three features, the low component overhead and robustness against circuit level errors, focusing on making incremental upgrades to a few key components could lead to significant reductions in the logical error rate. In particular, we saw that even if we assume the emitter error rate is fixed at some high-ish value, small improvements to the delay line error can drastically lower the logical error rate. So focusing on making this one component really good might get us pretty far. And yeah, thank you for coming to this talk.
Okay, let's all thank Kiana for a really nice talk. So do we have any questions? Okay, so I have a couple.
Okay, great. Usually when I give this talk, there's either no questions or a lot of questions. Like, I've given this talk in meetings that extended to 2 hours because it was just sprayed with questions.
Okay, let's see how we go. So so the first question I have is, you mentioned a bit about saying that you thought maybe the Phenonic platform is actually more promising for this kind of approach. Maybe could you say a bit more about that? Because I imagine that kind of optical fibers have already been quite optimized in terms of loss and things like this.
Right, optical fibers are quite optimized. But another thing you need to have is you need to be able to like couple the emitter to the data qubits very well. And that's sort of measured by the cooperativity. And it seems like they've sort of reached a limit for their cooperativity. And for our protocol, we need a cooperativity that's around, you know, the inverse of the threshold. So like maybe let's say 10 to the minus 3, whereas it seems hard to get the cooperativity below like order of magnitude 10 to the minus 2. For reasons I don't exactly understand, but this is what I hear from experimentalists. Whereas for Phenonics, they not only seem... people working in Phenonics seem to be very optimistic about getting the cooperativity a lot better. And as I said, they've managed to get like very long coherence times so that you don't really have to worry about loss. Whereas dephasing is more of a problem, but our protocol is actually very robust against dephasing because I don't know if you noticed, but if you just have single qubit phase errors in the circuit, then these always lead to single qubit set errors. The only time that you get these like multi-qubit local errors is when you have an S error in the circuit. So dephasing is actually very well handled. And the other thing is that if you want to, so for L, like a moderately large value, your optical fiber, you might need like many, many coils of it. And ultimately we want to make this into like a multiple qubit scheme where let's say the number of qubits scales with the number of emitters and delay lines. And for the purpose of like, you imagine if you just have like many, many coils of optical fiber in your computer, this might be less practical. Whereas Phenonic delay lines, for the numbers we're sort of considering here, a rough estimate suggests that maybe you just need like a few millimeters per delay line. So having maybe like a few delay lines of a few millimeters in your computer is a lot less daunting.
Okay, so that leads on nicely to like another question I had, which is, have you thought about kind of how you would do gates and stuff in a kind of in the full architecture? Because what you showed today is kind of like a quantum memory kind of thing, but then how do you do gates? How do you do like universal logic, that kind of things?
Right. So what we're sort of thinking about is like using lattice surgery. So you can imagine if you have two emitter setups, each, you know, generating a cluster state, then if you you can also mediate two qubit interactions between photons in the two different cluster states. If you route the photons such that like photon emitted by emitter one interacts with emitter two or something after a photon from emitter two interacts with it. And from my understanding, you can sort of mediate these like two qubit logical gates by just interacting like two layers of the 3D cluster state. And you might have to just do this for, you know, an L squared number of the photons And but yeah, a lot more work has to be done to figure out the details of that and calculate thresholds and whatnot.
Yeah, but I guess that doesn't change the like total delay time, like, or maybe change it by constant, but it won't make it scale differently if you just have,
right, exactly, if you can, yeah, if you can route photons between the emitters long enough.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think like this kind of lattice surgery based approach, and do you think you could like prepare magic states in the same way by like adapting things from these kind of surface code architectures?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, so we don't think that originally we were hoping maybe like Rasmussen's original protocol, where you just prepare like a really, really big cluster state and, mm-hmm, you know, punch defects and braid them. But you see that like if you have a fixed delay line error race, then there's a limit to how many qubits you can store, obviously. So in order to get computation, I think it makes a lot more sense to just have, you know, a number of logical qubits proportional to the number of emitters. And this will still have the same selling point in that each logical qubit still has a constant number of components, in contrast to the usual kind of setting where you imagine you need to like put like hundreds or thousands of physical qubits to make one logical qubit, and each of these physical qubits needs to be individually calibrated. But yeah, this is definitely a future work that I am eventually going to work on. Maybe not this year.
Great, thanks. And I actually had like one kind of very technical question. So about the simulations. So I see you did like like sizes of like L equals 37 or something up to there. How much compute time did it need to do this? Because like running matching on stuff that size seems like it might take a long time.
Oh, it actually wasn't so bad. So I was actually able to do like L equals like the low 30s, mm-hmm, on my laptop. Maybe not for all like 1 million trials. Mm-hmm. But like the decoder is, it's like quite simple. So Isaac told me like I had to write it in C++ or else it's not going to run fast enough. But like outside of the algorithm that implements Blossom for doing the minimum weight prefix matching, like everything else is basically just integer arithmetic. So I guess given this, you know, optimized Blossom package that does the
algorithm very Blossom fast. 5 or what did you use to do?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that was just like the rate limiting step, because everything else is very easy. For most of these numbers, I ran like preliminary results on my laptop overnight, and then we moved them to the cluster. But yeah, 37 wasn't so bad. We just stopped there because it seemed to be like, so this corresponds to a distance of like 19 or something, right? And that seems to be the numbers I saw in other papers going up to D equals 19.
Yeah, okay. Oh, okay, I see, yeah. Okay, distance 19, okay.
Right.
Okay, yeah, that makes more sense to me. Yeah, I was thinking it was like distance 37, and that's massive.
That would,
Okay. Okay. Great.
But we put the code online if you want to use it. I mean, I don't write code in a particularly collaborative, really, you know, nice fashion for other people to read. But it's, you can, we, one of my collaborators sort of black boxed it, and you can probably use it if you wanted to.
Oh, great! Thanks. Okay, cool. Do we have any other questions? Okay, well, if not, let's all thank Keanu again for a really nice talk.